Hello and welcome. It's Sunday and you're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, the ever lovable Mr. Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Howdy.
How you doing?
Doing good.
Enjoying your weekend?
I am, yeah.
Big 3-day plans?
Yeah, you know, we had IWI last night.
Right.
Out in Hopkins. Had a good turnout, had a good card. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm doing good. I'm still on the adrenaline high from
excellent.
That.
Yeah. Well, that's good. You know what? Holiday weekends, Tim, share a very interesting aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that these 3-day holiday weekends are sometimes the biggest weekends for UFO sightings?
That's what I hear, yeah.
I don't know. Do you think it's because people are out relaxing, looking up at the sky? They're not crammed in their cubicles, or they're not worried about getting to bed early? Do you think that might be part of why this happens?
I think that has a lot to do with it, yeah.
Well, 4th of July, we understand you're looking up at the sky.
Right.
And truly, if you're an alien race, what a cooler that's got to be like a vacation destination, right?
True,
they're like, hey, we've got to totally travel over to Earth because they blow up these sky flowers. You've got to see them. It's amazing, right? And they can just hover. Look at all the UFO sightings that take place. Mm-hmm. I caught photographs of weird stuff in the sky over Roswell during their 4th of July celebration.
Hmm.
I still don't know. I call the one Thor's hammer.
Yeah.
Because when I can't see it, but when I inverted, and it was a total accident, when I inverted the picture, there's this thing that looks like Mjolnir in the sky. It's got this kind of twisted handle and a rock head. I don't know.
Really?
I don't know what it is. Weird. Bill Chappell, I showed it to him. I go, Bill, what the hell is this? He goes, I don't know. Where did you see that? I said, I didn't. I just took a picture of the sky. And when I flipped the colors, you know, like to negative, that's when it was visible.
Weird.
Yeah, so some weird stuff. But, you know, since it is a holiday weekend, Tim, and we want to help people kind of escape, right? Maybe they're stuck at home and they can't escape. They can't get away. They're tied to the home because they've got to get back to work in a day or so, right? Tonight, we're going to transport them.
Okay.
Because, again, talking about UFOs, talking about this long holiday weekend, let's take people on a vacation to a balmy destination, Tim.
Oh.
Let's take them somewhere exotic where we can talk about the experiences that are taking place over the skies.
I like it.
Right? And we're going to do that with somebody in the know.
Okay.
Our guest is Beverly Trout. She's an assistant state director for MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, and is the chief investigator of MUFON's 5 active UFO investigators. For the state of Iowa, Tim. Far enough away? Exotic enough? Balmy destination, Tim. Palm trees.
Well,
warm sand.
It might have hit 90 this weekend, but I don't know about balmy and exotic.
It's our neighbor to the south, right?
Yeah.
All right, we'll take that. It's southern from Minnesota. Beverly Trout is our host, or our guest today. She is Iowa's assistant state director for MUFON. Beverly, thank you for joining us.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I have, reaching out to you, just chit-chatting and finding out how much is going on to the state adjacent to us was kind of astounding, and that's why I thought it'd be interesting to talk with you about it. When people think of UFO sightings, most of them we hear are coming from the West Coast, from the East Coast, and the, you know, the deserts and these kind of areas. Iowa just did not register with me as being a hotbed of UFO activity. Is there a pretty steady stream of unknown flying phenomena taking place over Iowa on a regular basis?
Well, there is, and in my 26 years, of course, I've run into some extremely interesting cases, and they're still happening, obviously. We actually have had quite a few triangles over Iowa. You're in Minnesota, so perhaps you might even know where the town of Britt is in Iowa, because it's very close to the Minnesota border and not far from Clear Lake in northern Iowa. And, for instance, during a lunar eclipse in September of 2015, when a lot of people were out, of course, looking up at the sky, within about a 4.5-hour time span, there were 14 triangles at fairly low level over Britt. And, of course, we were interacting with multiple witnesses. And, you know, when we talk about witnesses, oftentimes we're talking about people who are rather well-known in their communities. And obviously, in MUFON, we do not reveal witness identity. It's fine if the witness wants to, but we are sensitive to their career needs, their family needs, their friends, whatever. So that was quite an investigation, and we were interested enough that we had three of us who journeyed to Britt and interacted with these witnesses and so on. We've also had a very recent triangle sighting, by the way, at the north edge of Des Moines in south central Iowa. And this is a triangle at about 1,000 feet altitude, as estimated by the witness. Came directly overhead, did a maneuver, and adjusted its trajectory all in a split second, and then proceeded on, and then did another maneuver and did a hard right ankle turn, and, you know, very quickly disappeared. It was about a 10-second sighting. So, you know, and we've had them actually right in Des Moines.
Sighting like that over a busier center like Des Moines, are there multiple mm-hmm. witnesses that are calling this in from different angles? Was this a one-off kind of witness? What can you tell us about that?
What happens in these sightings so really pervasively is that you usually get one report and then nobody else reports. That's not to say that someone else might not have seen it, but not everybody is in the reporting mood.
Okay.
And so, you know, you understand. The other thing that can play into that, Dave, is that sometimes these sightings are orchestrated by the UFO crews for the benefit of a specific witness or witnesses. And so there can be a rather selective technology which can be activated by the UFOs to determine who gets to see and who is, you know, not perhaps switched off, shut out, just is not, you know, it's not visible to them.
Talk to me,
so
if you would.
The way that can play out.
Is there a military installation based in Iowa? And I apologize for my ignorance, but is there some kind of installation that would be interesting to alien phenomena?
Well, in the case of the Des Moines area, we have a National Guard facility called Camp Dodge, which is on kind of north of Des Moines, and by the way, not too far from where this particular sighting occurred. Now, whether or not that particular facility would have drawn any interest from the UFO, I guess, remains open to question, but my take is because that particular witness had also had another sighting 2 years ago of a triangle at very low level. On that occasion, it was around 2,000 feet, and he stopped his vehicle and stood underneath it for 2 minutes looking up at the underside and so on. So I would, as an investigator, need to strongly speculate that this particular witness is being targeted in some way, that the UFOs know that he's the one that they want to view what he is seeing. And so, you know, you get into this kind of thing.
All right. Let me start with your background, if you would. What specifically got you involved in investigating claims of UFO activity?
Well, you know, I'm an older person, and so back in the 1960s, to be specific, it was the night before Easter in 1967, And at that time, my husband and I had a dairy farm, milked a lot of cows. We were very close to the city of Des Moines. It would only take about 25 minutes to get into downtown Des Moines. And our farm buildings were situated right next to a creek. And so we had just, it was about heavy dusk. And when I say heavy dusk, of course, I'm talking maybe not quite, maybe astronomical dusk, you know, the third phase in the evenings that dusk goes through. At any rate, we had both been down in the milk house, the milk parlor, and I had come up through the barnyard, and then my husband came up through the barnyard, and we're standing there, and there's this object that's, my estimation is 200 to 300 feet land distance from us, and no more than maybe 100 feet in the air. And we're watching this silent object cross the creek back of our buildings very slowly, maybe 10, 15 miles an hour, if that fast. And then it got directly across the road from where we're standing, knowing that we cannot explain what we're seeing. And at that point across the road from us, it's above some trees. It drastically changed direction and shot off to the north. And, of course, because of the trees, it was quickly out of sight. Now, my husband at this point is muttering, "We don't want to get too excited about this." And so at that point, we had what is known in investigative research into UFOs as an inappropriate response. Now, the inappropriate response was we never said another word about the sighting that evening.
So and that was
however,
it. Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm curious. Okay, I understand that kind of, you know, I've been in situations where I've seen things I can't wrap my head around, and I just sit there and kind of chew on it, and I'm working it through before I really want to discuss what's going on. Is that what was going on, or do you feel that you were kind of, like your mind was numbed to what you experienced, almost maybe you were being manipulated to not really think that highly or think that much about it?
That's right. You hit on it because, no, it wasn't that our minds were working on it. It was simply, it was as if our minds were temporarily ignoring it. The next morning, of course, which was Sunday morning, Easter in 67, I was still at the house, and it was around 6 o'clock in the morning. And of course, my husband was milking the cows already, and he had a phone in the milk parlor. And of course, he gets on the phone and he calls up to the house, and he says, "Have you got the Sunday paper? Is there anything in the paper about what we saw?" So you see, at that point, his mind is turned on to reexamine this whole thing. And, of course, there was nothing in the paper. We did not know at that time who to report such an incident to. And I have to tell you that, you know, when you run a dairy farm every other day, at least in those days, a milk hauler with a great big tank truck would come, hook his pump up to the 1,000-gallon milk tank, and, of course, pump it out and so on. So when the milk hauler came, my husband and I were in the milk house. And so my husband proceeded to tell him what we had seen. And at that point, he proceeded to tell us what had happened along the railroad tracks that ran past the back of a neighbor's buildings who only lived about 3.5 miles away. So, of course, from his description, I would guess that maybe he may have seen something even more, maybe a little more startling, although I don't know how you can grade the startling ratio on these things, you know, when they're close up like that. So, you know, of course, that caught my attention. And even so, although I was somewhat interested in the subject, you know, for a number of years, I really did not become really active, almost as if a switch had been turned on, until in 1991, And in the fall, I became a member of MUFON. And then in the spring of 92, I remember, you know, sitting at my dining table and thinking all this over and thinking to myself, well, it appears to me that investigations is where it's at, so to speak, as far as finding out more about this.
Now, did you notice when you had this experience and a shared experience, which is really unique, did you notice any missing time at all? Did you notice any other strange phenomena, maybe silence, not just silence from the craft, but like everything else went quiet as well, or the sounds or smells or visuals were even more intensified? Was there anything aside from just the viewing of this craft that you are able to reflect back on?
What you're describing, you know, of course, is what we call dead silence, where there are no insects, no birds, I did not have that sensation, nor did it seem. We had two young children in the house at that time, and nor did it seem that we had any missing time as far as the clock would indicate. And so, you know, that was an interesting, of course, kind of a baseline from which to, you know, at a later date, somehow become a bit of a springboard onto the investigative scene. And, of course, I've got other cases. There are many encounters in Iowa, and actually I specialize in the encounter situations, and although I've been involved in others as well, you know, sightings and, you know, that sort of thing. And, of course, crop formations. We've had a few in Iowa that were reported, you know, that could be explored.
Well, I want to go back into your experience for just a little bit more, if we could, because,
sure.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
You kind of are in the same position Tim and I are with ghosts and other aspects of the paranormal. We're so nonchalant about it now because we've been around it and injected into it so deeply for so long.
Right.
You have this experience. You both kind of don't ask, don't tell about it for a while and then come back to it. When you start to revisit that and you start talking about that together, what were the logical steps? What did you try to persuade each other that you may have seen? How did that conversation go?
Well, we knew. And, of course, I read Edward Ruppelt's, the gentleman who, you know, headed up Blue Book for the Air Force. I read that then, of course, and also Incident at Exeter by, who was it, Fowler, the journalist. At any rate, so I was looking then at cases that seemed to be pretty objectively described. And obviously, I came to the conclusion, as did my husband, the UFOs, hey, there was something to this. And, you know, really, we didn't do, perhaps, a lot of discussion about the subject itself, but I always kind of kept in touch with it. And eventually, after 25, 26 years, my husband and I parted ways. And so then, you know, my interest kept on, and then finally kind of began to intensify with the 1991-92 period of time. And of course, I've been in it ever since. And of course, you mentioned the paranormal. That's a big thing with me because I understand that it's very important to know the difference between what is paranormal and what might be UFO screen memories presented to witnesses. And so I've delved pretty heavily into that.
All right. Talk us through that aspect. That's intriguing to me. If people think that they're seeing, quote unquote, shadow people or maybe having ghostly encounters at home, do you think that what they're dealing with is an alien implanted memory, a false flag or a false image that they're seeing to try to, you know, dissuade us from believing that it might be an alien being of some sort?
sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. I tend to, well, I've got three categories in which I put this paranormal and alien-related stuff into. You know, I guess the first one, if you'd like me to address this, is where you have both the paranormal and alien-related incidents, and I can give you a couple of examples here.
Please.
All right. And this first one concerns a now-deceased friend. I'll call him Ken. Ken was an excellent remote viewer. And, you know, in the Des Moines area, he was kind of known among those of us who were kind of delving into remote viewing on a kind of a playful, experimental basis in our local area. He was known as a very no-nonsense guy about his psychically activated abilities. So this incident that happened, he had been back to a conference. This is about 1996, by the way. And he had been back to a conference on the East Coast, and he was in the Boston airport getting ready to board the plane back to Des Moines. And knowing Ken, I'm not at all surprised that he purposely got on the plane among the first passengers, and then he purposely marched himself back to the back row of the plane's cabin in order to psychically scan the other boarding passengers. And suddenly, Ken's attention was focused on a tall, well-dressed, business-type individual putting his briefcase in the overhead. And instantly, Ken perceived that he was seeing a full reptilian alien, able to present himself in human form. Well, in that same instant that this washed over Ken's awareness, the individual turned his gaze clear to the back row of the airplane. And Ken forgot. He blanked the incident until the next day when he was in a local supermarket with his wife. Now, of course, when he got back to Des Moines, he called me up right away to tell me what had happened. And, of course, it seems to me rather obvious that, yes, Ken's paranormal abilities were activated. And it also seems obvious that this full alien had paranormal ability to temporarily block, you know, Ken's intrusion into his identity space. So it was an interesting example. And of course, I do think that there are many walking among us. Now, another example I have that I think speaks to this point of something being both paranormal and alien related actually goes back to a 1991 Iowa case that actually was reported to me last year. Sometimes, you know, these witnesses, when they're rather in their young years, like 19, 20, 21, 23, whatever, you know, at the point at which an incident happens, they're somehow inhibited from reporting it to anybody. But then when they mature and they're thinking about it and perhaps it's on their mind, you know, in other words, it's just kind of something that doesn't quite go away and they suddenly need somebody to tell us to. So this was reported last year, but it happened in 91. Now, at that time, this young man was farming with his parents. And on this particular day, bright, sunshiny day, he said, not a cloud in the sky. He happened to be standing. He was out in the cow pasture on an errand. And he's standing there when suddenly a huge shadow or blackness enveloped him. And, of course, he looked up, wondering what on earth. And at first, he was horrified to see a huge, he estimated that it was 600 feet on a side. This is a triangle. And he estimates it was only about 100 feet above him. And, of course, at first, horrified. Now, here's the hitch in the incident. The next thing he realizes is that he finds himself in a different location in the pasture, about 100 feet away from his original position. And instead of standing upright, as he had been when he first saw that shadow, he's now down on one knee. He's still looking up. And now he is no longer scared at all. And he describes it as the triangle moving so slowly that it took 4 to 5 minutes time span for it to move beyond his kneeling position in the pasture. Now, you know, obviously this incident was alien related. It was UFO related, and obviously his perception had been manipulated to block out whatever interaction precipitated, you know, his change of location when he finds himself down on his knee. And, of course, he's now psychologically drastically changed his perception of what's going on.
Right.
And the thing that's also rather interesting about this particular witness is that earlier in the year of 1991, he had been driving from a friend's home back to his parents' farm where he was farming with them. And he sees a light approach. At first, he thinks it's a helicopter and all this kind of thing, but it kept kind of jumping in its approach. That is, it would be in one location, he'd still be watching, and suddenly it would be in a location closer to him. Well, you know, the culmination was that it approached his car. It's at about 50 feet in altitude, and of course, as it approached his horizontal, his estimate is if it had flipped from the horizontal to the vertical, he could have reached out and touched it.
Ooh.
And in that case, there was a block that he could point to of missing time because he should have arrived home earlier in that 15-mile drive than he did. And I'm sure there are other, you know, researchers. Well, then, you know, you look at those where, you know, there's been some paranormal stuff that's been exercised in addition to whatever nuts and bolts, quote unquote, maybe, you know, involving the UFOs. But then you get to the UFO screen memory incidents. So if you'd like some examples on that, I've got some barn burners here.
Nah, who wants to hear good stories like that? I'll tell you what. Why don't we do this? I do want to hear those. I want to get into a lot of this. We have a theater of the mind, which I think ties in really interestingly with the stories you've been telling. So I want to make sure that we can cover that as well. Today, it's time to open the doors to the Darkhives as we go deep into the recesses of the vault and probe the files for this theater of the mind. Today's story comes from the real-life experience of Randy Bump. Nothing is quite as it seems. In the fall of 1989, I had had a long night of drinking and hanging out with my friends and decided driving was not in my best interest. I made my way around the noisy bar, saying my goodnights, exchanging handshakes, high fives, and hugs along the way. And when I finally crossed the gauntlet of drunken friends, neighbors, and coworkers, I reached the exit to the bar. When I pushed open the doors to the outside, I was met with a welcoming blast of fresh, cool air. And as the doors behind me closed, the sound of the party inside faded, and I set forth for my 2-mile walk home. I had walked this lonely walk many more times than I care to admit, but it was the right thing to do, and I refused to get behind the wheel of my car in this condition. Now, when I say this condition, I want it made clear. I was enjoying a nice mellow, and there may or may not have been some slight staggering on my walk home, but I was not fall-down stupid drunk. I was in a place of ease and comfort. You should know that for what I'm about to share. As I plodded along what seemed like an endless stretch of dark highway before me, I turned my hazy gaze to the skies above me, thoroughly enjoying the expansive night sky. That was when I noticed something dark, long and silent, hovering in the sky just ahead of me. It looked massive, maybe like a DC-10 in length, but it was triangle and hovered there silently. I kept my eyes fixed on the looming craft as I continued my journey. The mix of cool, fresh air and the slow but steadily increasing boost of adrenaline was rousing me from my inebriated state, and my fuzzy mind was becoming sharp and inquisitive as to what it was I was actually witnessing. The strange thing was that cars would whiz past me on this road, weary travelers seeking the safety of their homes, but no one seemed to be seeing what I was. Maybe they were too drunk or in just too big a hurry to cast their gaze towards the heavens, but I was enthralled. I noticed that as I got closer to the craft, the air was stale, not moving, and thick and muggy. Where moments before, and simply a few yards behind me, there was a gentle cooling breeze. Then the road around me lit up like daylight. It was as bright as high noon. I shielded my eyes with my hands and tipped my head back to look for the source that the light was coming from. It was blinding. My eyes squinted against the harsh, stark white light, and my hand moved to shield some of that light in an ineffective attempt to get a better look at what was casting this light down on me. When it got too intense, I squeezed my eyes tightly closed, head still tipped back. But when I opened them again, I was surprised to see that I was damn near home, and the light was gone. Now you should know, the place I stopped on the road to look upward to the light was still a good mile to maybe a mile and a quarter from my home. Now I was standing less than a few blocks away. I hadn't moved, it was just that fast. I looked at my watch, and to my irritation, it had stopped at about 1:18 a.m. I glanced back down the road towards my house and then turned to face the direction I had just come from. I was puzzled. I traveled a pretty good distance in the blink of an eye and had no memory of it. One minute I'm standing in the middle of the road staring skyward and shielding my eyes from a brilliant light. The next second I'm a mile or so down the road. I shook my head and headed towards home. Running the night's events through my mind, fast, then slow, then focusing on the event on the road, then I heard the noise of something moving behind me and closing in. Light footfalls on the pavement. I turned to see who was heading my way at this rapid pace, and to my utter disbelief, it was a short figure, huge head, giant black orb-like eyes. Not almond-shaped, they were rounded black pools of weirdness, and it was moving toward me with determination. I yelled, "Hey man, back off!" And to my astonishment, it stopped. And like a confused puppy, its head tilted to the side as if it was sad for having been spoke to so harshly. Then, the light struck the road a few hundred yards back up the road from where I had just been, and it began traveling silently but swiftly through the air. There was a sound of rushing wind, but nothing mechanical, no engine, just wind moving like a storm was blowing at breakneck speed. My little friend looked toward the light, then turned to face me again. Its face looked much less friendly this time, and it put its head down and began to charge me, the light falling in closely behind it. I didn't know what to do, but I did know I was ready to kick this little fella into next week if it kept running up on me. It seemed like the closer he got, the slower he moved, the louder the roar of the wind. I positioned myself to give this alien a hell of a kick, and it looked up at me, its mouth turned downward in a cross between pain and rage, and I let go with my leg. And at that exact moment, the light hit me. I was surrounded by the sound of crashing glass as my foot connected with the vase on my coffee table in my living room. I had sent it flying and it hit the wall hard, shattering into hundreds of pieces. The light flickering on and off, and my roommate came running down into the living room, baseball bat in hand, demanding to know what the hell just happened. I turned and said, I don't know. I seriously don't know. A minute ago, I was on the road down the block about to give a swift kick to something charging me, and the next thing I know, my kick connected to the vase, and I'm in my dark living room. He looked at me like I'd lost my damn mind, and I heard him mutter as he turned away to go back to his room. Drunk idiot. I stood there at a complete loss. What the hell just happened to me? I eventually made my way to the bathroom and decided to take a quick hot shower, and as I pulled my shirt over my head, I was astonished to see a series of red dots forming a triangle on my chest. Blood trickled from one of the wounds. I lifted my finger to the bleeding hole and touched it. I was met with white, hot, blinding pain. And when I let out a scream of pain, I found myself sitting bolt upright in my bed. That's when I heard the violent thumping on my wall. Three loud bangs against the wall. I was terrified, unable to move. That's when I heard my roommate yell from the next room, "Keep it down in there, Jesus! People are trying to sleep!" I shook my head, reached to my chest, and found scabbed over wounds that looked days old. I thought I was losing my mind. I laid down and closed my eyes, my mind whirling. And then as I began to fall asleep, I saw him, his face, those big round black eyes, and the turned down mouth opened, and from it a loud, ear-shattering noise that sounded like an alarm clock. My alarm clock. I opened my eyes and hit the snooze button. I looked at the clock, and in amazement, it was 11 a.m., 2 days later.
Beyond the darkness.
There's something weird over the skies of Iowa, and we're talking about it today with Beverly Trout. She is the Assistant State Director for MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, which was founded back in 1969. She's a Chief Investigator for Iowa, MUFON's five active UFO investigators. And she's here talking to us about a lot of great stories, accounts, and some of her own personal stories as well. Before the break, you said you've got a great load of stories to share with us regarding, what do you call them, screen memories?
Yes. Okay. You know, we've been talking about, I just related to, you know, we're going to go a couple of incidents that illustrate both the paranormal and alien related within the same incident. And then my second category that I really have been interested in, of course, for many years is UFO screen memory incidents. And so I've got a couple of those that I think you might be interested in.
Well, let's hear what you've got.
All right. Back in 1997, a father and his then teenage son were out hunting. And this is in winter, snow on the ground. They're coming up over a rise, and as they come up over, they look down onto kind of a creek bank, onto a creek bed, and there they see a wolf frantically dashing back and forth and back and forth in the snow. Now, of course, this is Iowa. We've got coyotes in this state, you know, and I suppose there might be a wolf or two, but they're kind of rare. Well, then the wolf departs the area, and the father looks at his son and says, "Did you see what I saw?" And the son answers, "I saw a wolf." Well, fortunately, this father and son are inquiring people, and they go down into the area where they had seen this wolf dashing back and forth in the snow, and they checked for tracks. And, of course, they're astonished when there are no tracks to be found. Now, subsequently, this father and son have become consciously aware of UFO experiences. But, you know, then to go on, because this is the tale not only of one wolf, but of two. Fast forward to February 2nd of 2015. The first incident happened in 97. Now we're in February 2015. The father's mother, the previous year, had moved from the West Coast to Iowa to be near her son and had a home in a town close by where he lived. And at dusk, as she's gazing out her patio doors, she's seeing a wolf bound across her snow-covered, six-foot fenced backyard. Well, of course, when her son quickly arrived on the scene, he's checking for tracks in the snow. And again, as in 1997, there were no tracks in the snow. Now, you know, and by the way, information has subsequently emerged that this mother and her late husband had experienced previous UFO sightings and experiences, but she was not a person to talk about these things, you know, until there's some compelling incident that might prompt her to do so. And, of course, you know, you're looking at incidents where somehow you've got rather ordinary circumstances, but there's a bizarre element that is also included. And I can give you another example, which I think is rather interesting. You know, when the screen memory pulls the witness's front and center attention onto the screen memory. But, you know, always there's enough environmental caveat, you know, such as the lack of the wolf tracks, you know, that gets the witness to thinking, wait a minute, what's happening here? So the second example happened in 2003. A couple who, over the 4th of July weekend, had been to Minnesota, was on their way back into Iowa, and they were on Highway 169 north of Adel, Iowa, which is a town that's, oh, I think about 15 miles west of Des Moines. And this is about 2:30 in the morning as they're driving back, and three happenings occurred within a four-mile stretch. And I need to say, you know, I might be able to discount the first happening if no further incident had occurred. But anyway, here's what happened. First of all, a deer came onto the highway, but the car did not hit it. You know, they just slowed down and everything came out okay. Now, that's the one that maybe you could discard if you didn't have the other two things happening. About 2 miles further on, the couple sees an ambulance sitting in the center of the highway. Headlights were on, driver's door was open, the rear doors were open, and the area lights were on as if it was working in emergency. But there was no emergency to be worked. The flashers were not on. The area was deserted. There was no emergency at all needing attention. And, of course, at this point, the couple is easing their way around this vehicle that's sitting in the middle of the highway. They go another 2 miles further on, and at this point, they are seeing what looked to be a man standing motionless, not moving, with his back next to the highway. He was not engaged in any activity that would justify his presence or his stance. And there was no farmstead, and there was no residence in the area, and there was no vehicle in the area. And, of course, at this point, the driver is muttering, "Shall I stop?" And his female companion is saying, "No, no, drive on." Because, of course, at this point, they're well spooked. Now, you know, as an investigator, I look at screen memories as substitutes, which are really presented to obscure something totally different taking place during the screen memory event. You know, I teach UFO classes for the adult education department of the Des Moines School District, and I always tend to define screen memories as a, you know, something, it's a presentation, something rather ordinary, but it's always couched or presented in somewhat unusual environment or circumstances and so on. So in other words, you know, so the witness has real problems in trying to satisfactorily connect all the dots within the, you know, framework in which the incident plays out. And to me, as an investigator, it's almost as if someone, something is saying to the witness, pay attention. You know, there's something going on in your life experience, which is beyond your current paradigm. What you see is not what is necessarily actually occurring. And so, you know, the screen memories, and of course, any number of cases by various researchers have pointed to screen memories as part of the technology ability of UFO alien crews and so on. So it's interesting. And then you get into the strictly paranormal incidents with no alien input. And I've run across some really interesting examples in those cases as well, if you'd like to hear those, Dave.
Of course, please. I find this stuff fascinating. And the way you deal with it, when you talk to somebody, though, that has had one of these kind of screened memories, do you try to talk mm-hmm. them through that, or do you just let them relate the story to you? I'm just curious, how do you get people to the point of understanding what they may have really been dealing with?
Well, obviously, I allow them to tell the story, asking any pertinent questions that I can think of. For instance, in the story of the wolves, you know, were there any tracks? Well, of course, the big deal in telling it to me is we didn't find any tracks, you know, this sort of thing. And so, you know, actually, you know, when the witnesses have someone who actually will listen to something that's maybe previously been outside their paradigm, you know, this actually kind of introduces, I think, a certain level of comfort. And that is, they're able to open up, whereas with perhaps their next door neighbor or even family or friends, this might be a no-no, you know, in there. The inhibitions might be kind of firmly in play, whereas with someone like myself, then there's, I think, a bit more willingness. And, you know, there are even some things, I guess, that I could comment on as far as there have been cases where I have realized that the witness might have been very inhibited with a male investigator. And the fact that I, as a female investigator, was along really kind of was a more of an open door for someone to come forth with looking. But that's kind of a, you know, that digresses a little bit, I guess. At any rate, on the strictly paranormal level, and this particular individual that I'm going to tell about, mm-hmm. I've known her for 22 years, so I am fully acquainted with her integrity and honesty and so on. At any rate, what I want to relate is that when she was at the age of 5, she could see a friend in her environment. She called him, and she called this friend Peter. And actually, this greatly upset her parents. And they would argue with her over what they considered to be, you know, a childish fantasy. And one day, she and her father were visiting at her grandparents. And at the age of 5, you know, she speaks up to say she's seeing Peter. And, of course, her father immediately took issue with her. And she happened to be holding a ball in her hand at the moment. And she tossed the ball, and the ball immediately disappeared. Now, of course, her father angrily, and I do say very angry, according to her description, searched high and low for that ball, but, it, you know, it just could not be found. Well, that's not exactly the end of the story. If you fast forward in her life for 50 years, when she was in her mid-50s, and there came a new psychic individual into town where she lived, and she went for a reading, and of course this psychic had never met her nor heard of her. And I should say this about this witness: to this day, she's a reticent kind of an individual, very quiet spoken and always kind of reticent about her experiences. At any rate, she goes for this reading, you know, 50 years later, and she sits down for the reading, and the psychic looks up at her and he says, "Well, I guess I'm supposed to tell you, your guide says he has your ball." And, of course, this got her attention big time because she's remembering that incident that happened at the age of five. You know, that's strictly paranormal. Another interesting incident that came my way, a medical examiner who now lives in another state told me of an incident that happened as she was preparing to autopsy a 40-year-old female who had, and this lady, the female, had suddenly died from an unexpected allergic reaction at a restaurant, so they weren't able to get help to her, and so she'd passed on. And so in the autopsy room, this medical examiner has already neatly laid out her stainless steel instruments, and then when she turned away from the table briefly, suddenly all the instruments crashed to the floor. Now, thankfully, this particular medical examiner, whom I've known for several years, was savvy enough about the paranormal to realize that she needed to walk over to the body and say, "Now, I'm going to get this over with as soon as possible." And, of course, the autopsy proceeded with no further interruption. And as the medical examiner was telling me about this incident, you know, she's also indicating to me that paranormal happenings are fairly common talk among medical examiners when they gather at meetings and conferences and so on. So, you know, you've got all of these interesting incidents that point to the strictly paranormal. So, you know, when you get into my three categories, you know, both paranormal and alien related,
right.
And the second one is screen, and then the strictly, you know, it just is an interesting combination. I do, I've always remembered, kept a file, you know, the famous remote viewer Ingo Swann.
Right, who just passed away, right?
Right, several years back. Mm-hmm. But, you know, way back in actually the September 1992 issue of Fate magazine. That's an old magazine that I don't even know whether or not it still exists.
It does, and it's based right here in Minnesota. So, yes, it does still exist.
You know,
I think it's a quarterly magazine now.
I knew that was Minnesota-born. You know, he wrote an article in that particular issue, and he offered his thoughts on the need for, you know, you and I as supposedly humans and others to get on a more balanced playing field with whatever alien intelligence has presented itself on this planet, and I think we've got plenty of it. And, you know, he's putting forth in that particular article a strong argument that it appears that the common denominator between them and us, and by the way, I'm not an us versus them individual.
Okay.
You know, I'd like for all of us to get along.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he's saying that the human psychic capabilities as well as the ET are a common denominator. And if that's the case, and we are the kind of undeveloped portion of that, maybe we need to get busy and look to see about expanding our own consciousness and that kind of thing, you know. At any rate, that's my, and I'm fully in there with that. I have, by the way, abductee, contactee, experiences, whatever you want to call them. I have a witness, for instance, who I've known for 5 years, and very intelligent person, and it would appear that some kind of perhaps latent ability has emerged in that last 5 years, in her kind of middle years, which seems to be coming pretty information seems to be coming pretty fast and so on. And she happens to also be a witness who has been part of operating the ships when she's on board. And, of course, she's not the only one where that's been reported and so on.
Wait, so they've been abducted to help fly the alien craft?
Yeah. And, you know, this is actually, this is reported... this is reported every once in a while. Let me put it that way. Frequently enough to you know, pay some attention to it. Which, of course, well, okay, let's go back here. I don't know if you may be familiar with Grant Cameron, the well-known Canadian UFO researcher.
Yes.
And, you know, Grant, whom I have high respect for, long ago has said, you know, he's pointed to a gentleman by the name of Wilbert Smith, who back in 1950 was head of the Canadian government agency that was concerned with what they called flying saucers at that time. And, you know, there's some documentation to back up that when Wilbert Smith advised the U.S. authorities, what was indicated to him was that mental phenomena was a part of how the aliens can fly the craft, as well as, of course, how they communicate with UFO experiencers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and then I also remember, for instance, as another, just another example, Lynn Buchan, you know, the remote viewer. I remember him telling, I think he was on Coast to Coast one night back in 2014, and he's telling his story of being an abductee. And some 4 years before that, when he was allowed to pilot the craft because the aliens deduced that he was an aware individual and there were other people on board, but they were on board for other purposes. And, of course, then I've got, you know, my own case here in Iowa. this person who has not only been required to operate the ship through, in her description, Dave, what she indicates is that she does not link to the ship. The ship links to her. And actually, I have seen this description given by a witness that another researcher interacted with. So that's kind of interesting, and of course, you know, there's more. There's a lot more, I guess, that could be said about that kind of thing. But it has raised some really interesting questions in my. Well, I think they're interesting because I'm the one that I thought. Well, when we're on board UFOs and we're asked or required to operate some equipment or actually operate the craft. Is it possible, you know, that when we're taken from our normal environment, do humans somehow operate at an elevated level of intelligence? In other words, you know, are we smarter on board than in our normal environment? So, you know, I put this question out to a few folks that I knew that were interested in the subject of UFOs, and one of them said, I'll call him Bob. He said, well, if they can take us through solid walls and doors, alter our memories, submerge us in liquid for space flights without drowning us, speak to us without actually talking, and change our DNA, I'm thinking they can have us drive one of their craft. And so that was his take. Well, then another recipient of my question, I'll call her Pam, she said, well, seems to me that when humans are abducted, they enter an altered state of consciousness of sorts. And then she goes on and she says, my favorite altered state is brought on by the use of laughing gas when I'm at the dentist. I've noticed that as long as I'm under its influence, my thoughts are positively profound and have a clarity they lack in my usual conscious state. It also seems that this clarity is not added to my thinking process so much as my thinking process is released from its normal restricted state. So,
well, hold on one second, though, Beverly. Tim and I went to college together, and there were many drunken nights where we thought we had tapped into our genius gene. And I'm 99% confident that if we ran a recorder and played that back, what at the time thought and sounded very deep, very intellectual, I'm sure sounded much more like, did you see that girl? Yeah, she is beautiful. And we thought we were having a much richer conversation. So I don't know that in an altered state, and I know where I know what she's talking about, because I've been in an altered state with alcohol and a drug or two in my youth that made me feel like I was a hell of a lot smarter than I really am. And only later did I find out just how stupid I really was. So is she really uncovering a mystical aspect of her being, or is she just tricking herself thinking that she's unlocked that magical genie?
Well, that remains open to question, of course. But I suppose the question that remains, is it us or is it them who bring about something different when we're, in other words, taken from our normal environment? Are they able to synchronize the right and left sides of our brain in some way? Are they using their consciousness technology? Or their physical mechanical technology to influence our functioning level. In a way, if there is an intelligence elevation, and that's a big if, that comes from the aliens, could it be that they may want us to realize that we have maybe some previously unsuspected capabilities? I can ask the questions. If I could answer them as easily, I might have something going here. it's an interesting thing. Now, in connection maybe with that, I don't know if you've you may be familiar with the American Indian PhD R.D. Six Killer Clark.
Yes, we've had him on our show in the past.
Oh, good. She has written, especially, I like all three of her books, but her first one tells of an incident that kind of speaks to what you and I are talking about. She tells about an Alaskan university-educated American Indian who I think just happened in 2007, if I remember correctly. At any rate, who had planned maybe to become a teacher, but when his grandfather retired from operating a snowplow, he took the job. And, in her telling of it, apparently there was a 50-mile assigned stretch of road. And what would happen in a heavy wind-blowing snowstorm and so on, as happened on this particular occasion, there would be one snowplow at one end of the 50 miles and another one at the other end. And they would, plow, meet each other, go right on past the 50-mile mark, turn around, come back and do it again. Because, of course, the snow and the wind and all that sort of thing would be continually piling up the snow. And on this particular occasion, this particular gentleman got to about midway. And suddenly, in the midst of all of this noise and wind and snow, about 20 feet in front of the plow, there's a disc sitting right on the roadway. And if I remember correctly, I think it had orange lights on it at that time. And, of course, apparently the disc crew was just as startled as the snowplow driver. And immediately it took off and the lights on the thing turned white. Well, the driver became aware that his snowplow had shut down. And, of course, in that kind of weather, and the cold and so on, that's not a happy thing to happen. But luckily it started right back up and he got a little bit of speed and then he felt a bump. And of course he stopped and he's getting ready to climb down out of the cab and find out what on earth he had bumped into. Well, at that point, before he could get down out of the cab, a hand shows up on the window and then a face. And apparently one of the crew had got left behind. And, he's not about, of course, to get out of the cab at this point. So then suddenly this individual, the UFO crewman, the alien, kind of a diminutive stature, by the way, but apparently looked human, was suddenly standing right in front of the snowplow on the roadway and communicating that he was cold. And the snowplow driver is apparently communicating back, well, come on up into the cab. He wasn't going to leave somebody to, you know, die in the cold. And at first, you know, the little alien seemed to be somewhat reluctant and kind of ran off to the side of the road towards some trees. But then suddenly he's back in the roadway, and again, the snowplow driver is indicating, you know, come into the cab. And, of course, he expected him to climb up the ladder to get into the cab. That didn't happen. He just simply appeared in the cab. Well, and of course, he needed to go on the other 25 miles to reach the end of that 50-mile stretch. And turn around and head back. And, of course, when he got back to the spot where he picked up this crewman, there, of course, was the disc. They realized they'd left him behind, and they're back to pick him up. And at this point, the little alien simply appears in the roadway and raises his hand in a farewell and then disappears inside of the disc. Now, some conversation, I should say some communication, had occurred during the pickup and, you know, the and so on. So during that 50 miles that they would have gone on and then come back to the spot where he's picked up. And during that time, the alien wanted to know about the technology associated with the snowplow and, of course, the oil-based thing seemed rather primitive to him, and he was reported as making the comment that our scientists ought to be looking into magnetics. And the snowplow driver asked him how he was able to simply move himself from one place to another. Excuse me. And at this point, he made a comment which kind of speaks to what we were talking about, this operating of ships. He said, if you knew how to use your brain, you could do it too. And I thought that was a rather significant comment, obviously. Yeah. We apparently have some built-in, perhaps, capabilities that we have not explored. And so we get back to Ingo Swann's, you know, injunction, hey, folks, get busy. You know, learn what you really are, who you really are,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of interesting.
Very interesting. I want to touch base with you. I know time is running out on us here. I wanted to hear a little bit about some of the crop circle stories and what your take is on that in connection truly with UFO activity. Is it something that is tied directly to UFO activity, or do you believe it is a separate phenomenon unto itself? Beverly Trout is our guest. She is Iowa's Assistant State Director of MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. A lot of fascinating stories and accounts that you've been sharing with us. But you had mentioned crop circles earlier. I want to kind of end on that as if we can. And you're certainly a plethora of information. We'd love to have you back on the show to chat about more. But tell me about this phenomena taking place in Iowa, and do you believe truly that this is an effect of UFOs or alien culture, or do you think that we may be dealing with something completely different?
Well, I tend, let me put it that way, I tend to think that probably it's UFO related. You know, there have been videos seen of balls of light coming down over fields and, you know, some appearance and so on. Now, not always do you see a visible UFO, however, which, and of course, you know, these aliens have said time and again, you know, we can be hovering right above your head and you don't know we're there because there's an invisibility factor. And I've run into cases in Iowa, the invisibility thing, where they were seeing something but no UFO, and yet they were looking in the sky as if they were being allowed at something, but, you know, the actual craft was not showing. So, and then, of course, there's a video from way back in 1989, which I, along with an audience in Denver several years back, saw the video taken by an educator in the daytime of a UFO. I think it was estimated at a couple thousand feet. And it he had time. Apparently, it wanted to be videotaped. He had time to go in the house and get his, what was then called camcorder, and bring it back out. And what was not noticed, obviously, until the video then was played back and slowed down, was that at one point the UFO actually goes invisible and then very quickly becomes visible again. And it was done in conjunction with a bird that was kind of flying up toward the UFO, and at the apparently at the when the bird intersected with the UFO, both the bird and the UFO went invisible. Then the UFO becomes quickly visible again, and then the bird is seen as falling, and they don't know whether it was dead or whether it was stunned or what. But at any rate, there is that element of invisibility. I also remember Nancy Talbot, who is, I think, rather well-known liaison in the U.S. with scientific personnel who are interested in investigating crop formations. And Nancy had called me right after she got back from Holland in 2001. Excuse me, because what had occurred, she and the young man in the house had been talking about crop formations. She'd gone up to the second floor and was in bed, but there were patio doors leading out, and she saw three pillars of light come down. Didn't see a UFO, saw three pillars of light. Well, at the same time, the young man, the rest of the family had gone on to bed, but the young man was yelling at her. He saw the first two pillars and then didn't see the third one, just because he was yelling for her because he saw something. Well, when they got, you know, investigating the next morning, and it was already, I think, around 3 o'clock in the morning when this happened, about 80 feet from the back door of that home, there was a crop formation. And as I recall, I believe it was in green beans. Now, there was no UFO seen, but there was some source of energy which appeared to come from out of the air. And so, you know, I tend to think, yeah, we've had a few that have been investigated in Iowa. One was in 1995 at Arlington, Iowa. This farmer was actually an official in the Iowa Corn Growers Association. And he later said, I knew when I walked in that field, I couldn't explain what I was seeing because it was, you know, rather intricately laid in the month of August. So the corn was still green, obviously. Then we had a formation near Nevada, Iowa, north of Des Moines, about 35 miles. And that was in a soybean field at harvest. Very dry, very dry. Beans, you can combine beans up to, what is it? I don't even know the highest percentage. I know up around 17% because they've got drying ability these days. And, you know, if you had walked in that field and just simply, you know, put your hand, your fingers on a stem, you would have heard the crackle, the little snap, because they were that brittle. Well, all of these soybeans, of course, were laid flat to the ground, and there was no breakage. And so, of course, it has some very, very interesting characteristics to the genuine article. Now, if you're going to go in a field and you see a bunch of stuff mashed down and broken and so on, well, then you're going to think somebody's playing the game, you know. So that's about where it is. And, of course, we found we would send some samples to a gentleman by the name of Lemongood in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
and liaise actually that activity through Nancy Talbot, because she was involved very heavily in this. And, you know, they would find some anomalies, some nodes that were that looked as if they had been, looked as if they'd been in a microwave oven. And also magnetic particles per gram of soil were found to be very high, much higher than the background magnetic particles that are found in soil. So, you know, you've got these anomalies. And when there's an anomaly, you say, okay, you know, this is pretty interesting. We don't know exactly, but it remains an anomaly, certainly. So that's about where we're at there.
Beverly Trout, it's fascinating chatting with you. I know our time is up, and I would love to visit with you again. Maybe every quarter we can have you pop on and update us on new accounts, new stories, and what's going on, especially with the activity right down to the south of us here in Minnesota. Thank you so much for joining. And if people have a sighting, you said not talking about it, not the right idea. What is the best thing for people to do if they have a sighting, even if they're afraid that, you know, they may be mocked or ridiculed? MUFON will not do that. They're going to take a look at these seriously. How do they reach out? How do they get help from MUFON?
Well, they can either go to the, of course, the MUFON website, where you can report and you can indicate that you want to remain anonymous. You have to give your name and address and so on, but, you know, to the public anonymous. The other thing that has happened on many, many occasions is that cases have come directly to me, and usually this will involve encounter cases because they do not wish to have the incident reported to any organization. And so they'll come directly to me, you know, having learned, you know, that I'm in that specialty. So then they have somebody to listen to and understand, since I, you know, have some familiarity with the encounter situation.
Do you have, I'm just curious, as we wrap up the show, do you have a really creepy encounter that was ever shared with you regarding these aliens? And if so, would you mind sharing that with us right now?
Well, you know, sometimes creepiness is in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
You know what I mean. Let me go to the maybe unusual.
Okay.
You know, and oftentimes, you know, I talked about inappropriate response. And that, of course, in itself is kind of, let me tell you, if you have the time, of an incident that happened. A lady was on her way to a hospital for an appointment. And this is in the morning, maybe a little before 8 o'clock, because it was an early appointment. And so as she approaches this complex, she sees a UFO at low level. She thinks no more than 50 feet above the treetops. And this is along the river. And so, you know, up on the high banks of the river, there's a lot of trees, et cetera. There happens to be some student housing that was at one end of this complex. And the parking lot where she was to pull into was at that end of the complex as well. And so that she could go into the main building for her appointment. At any rate, so she's thinking, oh, my, I'm going to pull in the parking lot and then I can get out of the car and I can see this better. Because, of course, she's looking through her windshield to begin with and, you know, looking at angles. Sometimes you're better off when you're outside the car. So she pulls in the driveway, she pulls into the parking lot, she parks. She does not even look in that direction. She simply gets out of her car and walks in the building and forgets about it until the next morning. And, you know, the object was probably no more than, because, of course, I went to the site and I'm looking over all the terrain and so on, probably no more than a couple of hundred feet from where she parked her car. But you see, again, there is that, if you want to call it creepy,
right?
there's that sort of thing and that can happen. And so, you know, a little bit similar, I suppose, to what I was relating earlier about the gentleman I called Ken in the Boston airport, you know, when he was made to forget. So, you know,
very cool stories. Beverly, thank you so much for joining us. And for all of you in the Iowa area, come on out and meet me. I'll be at Wizard World in Des Moines, Iowa, June 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. I'll be hosting panels with some of the cast members of Supernatural, Matt Ryan from Constantine, Butch Patrick from The Munsters will be on hand. Plus, I have three paranormal-themed talks that will be taking place, one each day, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I will be at a number of different Wizard World conventions throughout the year. I've got a great discount offer code for any of you, no matter which one of the Wizard World conventions you want to attend, whether I'm going to be there or not. Go to wizardworld.com and use the code DARKNESS20 to save 20% off of tickets for your adventure. So again, go to wizardworld.com. If you find an event in a location you'd like to attend, whether I will be there or not, make sure that you use DARKNESS20 at checkout to take advantage of those deeper discounts and getting 20% off of your total order. That's it for today. We will be back again with you next weekend with brand new episodes of the best in paranormal talk radio. And remember to join me Monday through Friday in the best of anomalous talk radio as I host Midnight in the Desert. You can find information at midnightinthedesert.com, a live show Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. to midnight Pacific time. That's 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. Central time, midnight to 3 a.m. Eastern time. More information can be found, and you can subscribe and become a time traveler with us at MidnightInTheDesert.com. We will be back again next week. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Beyond the Darkness.